ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that on one's 250th birthday, there should be a celebration. I'm Claire Nichols, and on The Book Show, we're raising our teacups to Jane Austen.
Why Austen? What is it about her?
Authors Colm Tobin, Karen Joy Fowler, and more will explore why, in 2025, the Austen effect is bigger than ever.
That's quite incredible.
Search for The Book Show and look for Dear Jane wherever you get your podcasts, or hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
This is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, coming to you from Gadigal land. Helen Garner pretends she doesn't know why this is happening. Of course she does, but she puts on her I'm just a Melbourne grandmother face as news rolls in that her books are taking off in America, that she's won the Bailey Gifford Prize for the Diaries in Britain, and that her readers are excited to have a new Garner in the shops. The Mushroom Tapes, Conversations on a Triple Murder Trial. The conversations are with the formidable writers Chloe Hooper, author, among other books, of The Tall Man, and Sarah Krasnostein, best known for The Trauma Cleaner. The trio drove to and from the trial of Erin Patterson in a bush town in Victoria, talking all the way, dissecting a case that came to have an audience around the world. The Mushroom Tapes is true crime served three ways. Helen, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you, David.
Your first sentences are famous. Who chose the first sentence of this? It starts and we're not even there.
Well, I'm sorry to tell you it wasn't me. I think it was a friend of one of the other two who put this forward. She read some of the work as it was going along and she said, it started and you weren't even there. I think she said it in that kind of rather reproachful tone.
Exactly.
And somebody went, oh, whoa, there's the first sentence.
Because you actually discuss what the first sentence might be. You're all aware of this issue. It matters. You were not there because the three of you were somehow in a high-minded way determined not to be there, but then something happened.
Mm. We were aware that there had been this very strange murder, three murders as it happened, but a sort of hysteria seemed to burst out quite early in the piece when it became public. And I don't know if we were feeling sort of snobby about it because everybody was talking about it all over the world, or whether we just thought, oh, well, this is covered already. There's people out there who are handling this.
Don't need us.
No, they don't need us. Anyway, we've got other. The other two were Chloe and Sarah. Both had other projects on the go. They and I. If it hadn't been so far away, Morwell is. It's about almost 3 hours from where I live in Melbourne on the road. So I wouldn't have gone. I'm too old and crabby and I don't like driving much anymore on freeways. That's my grandmother face that you mentioned.
Yes.
And
you should have seen the grandmother face, ladies and gentlemen, when I mentioned the grandmother face. Yes, Helen?
Well, yeah, so I thought, oh, well, you know, someone will handle this and someone will write something interesting about it. And in fact, I wasn't really all that interested at the beginning. But so I was just hanging around. I'd just published the book about my grandson's footy team and I was still going out there on the road with that. And then I heard from Sarah and Chloe, both of whom I knew but was by no means close friends with. I didn't know them that well. And they said, look, we're going to go down to Morwell. Why don't you come with us? And I thought, oh, that could be fun. That could be interesting. Because a writer's life is quite lonely and solitary usually. And I wasn't working on anything. I was just doing publicity for the last thing I'd done. And I thought I might have fun and talk to some other writers and crack a few jokes and find it an interesting story. So that's how it happened.
The three of you all confess that there was one detail that really struck you, and that was the different coloured plates.
Yes. When Erin Patterson served the lunch to her parents-in-law and the two other members of her family, she served each person their own share of that.
Individual beef Wellingtons.
Which is
not the way to cook beef Wellington.
Apparently it's a sort of communal thing.
Yes.
Yeah. But anyway, so one of the victims, her mother-in-law's sister, remarked on the way to the hospital, having been vomiting and had violent diarrhea all night long after the lunch, she said, "Is Erin short of crockery?" And she noticed that there was a different coloured plate. And it's the kind of thing that all your alarms go off. And
well, they do now.
Yeah, they do now, but it seemed weird. And as Sarah says somewhere in the book, you notice things and what they're saying to you is, "I'm weird, but I'm weird for a reason."
The plates were grey for everybody else, but white for her?
No, I think her plate was a sort of an orangey brownish or a browny orange. I think it was a very noticeably different colour.
And the poison went out on the grey plates. Yeah.
That's right, yes.
Helen, in that footy book, the book of the season that you wrote about your grandson playing football, and I think of your grandson saying to people, "My granny is Helen Garner, don't mess with me." But you say there was a day which was wet and cold and shitty and you almost didn't go, but you thought, "I will, because a couple of small human things will always happen." And it seems to me that your finding of small human things is one of the strengths, beauties of your work. The looking for small human things, the colour of plates, but all through your description of the trial, there are these small human things. How do you know when you've found one of these illuminating small human things? Are you aware that you're searching for them?
Well, I'm not exactly searching, but I'm trying to remain open to them because they're always there. When I was young and I had vague ideas that maybe I might like to write something one day, I used to think that I wouldn't be able to because it seemed to me that I was surrounded always by this sea of tiny details. And I thought, I don't know how I could ever. I mean, that's not what you need to write a book, I ignorantly thought back then. I thought I could never imagine finding a sort of a form or anything that would hold all the things that interested me that were so tiny. But I don't know, as the years went by, I realised that what treasures they were and how there are ways that you can use them and they serve themselves to you. And I'm often surprised by how everybody doesn't feel like that. For example, yesterday I went with Ambie, my football-playing grandson. We went to a pub because he's now like 18 and works in a bar, but be that as it may, we went to a pub to hear his sister sing, and she sings jazz, and she sings with a wonderful guitar player, and the thing about the guitar is that it's very intricate. The music that he plays is wonderfully delicate and accurate and constantly changing, and I love watching his face when he's playing because great streams of expression pass across this man's face. He's a young guy, he's got a rather gaunt face, and I was watching him and I saw it was almost like watching someone else's dream while it was happening. Sometimes he would laugh or smile and then his face would become serious, and sometimes he would just go vague and his eyes would dream out the window towards the traffic passing, but always this stream of music was pouring from him. And afterwards I said to Ambie, "Isn't it wonderful the expressions that pass over Declan's face when he's playing?" And he said, "What? I didn't notice anything." So that either means that he's a footballer or it means that there's something weird about me.
No. You have writer's eyes. There's a wonderful little detail in the book that in the evidence it turns out that the page on which the recipe for beef Wellington appears in the book Tin Eats, page 252, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, if you're at all interested out there, that page is food splattered. And we know that, don't we, from our own cookbooks.
Yes. That's the giveaway.
What we cook is splattered with food.
Yeah.
It's giveaways, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. But of course it's court. A court is this cataract of fabulous detail. And the things that I notice in a court, I could never squeeze into one book because there's so many of them, thousands. And little tiny power struggles between the people, I was going to say in the audience, I mean the people who are
in the gallery.
Or watch in the gallery, or the sort of little struggle you go through every day on the way through security. And actually, that was really funny because Morwell is a town, it's in the part of the country where there used to be, well, still are, brown coal mining area.
Major emitting country.
Yes, huge. But a lot of the mines are now closed down. And so there's plenty of guys there who are former miners and who have lost their mining work. So at the court, and there's also a fair amount of unemployment, so you get, you know, in the court, which contained the magistrates' court, you know, all levels of courts happen in the same building there. So the security guys, these massive dudes, you know, middle-aged ones who are built with huge shoulders and muscly arms, and they all wear black T-shirts and they've got savage faces. And I was really scared of them, and I sort of tiptoe in with my little case. Because I would go down there and stay sometimes in a motel by myself when the others went back to town. And one day I went in, and I was actually quite nervous about them. I didn't have anything in my bag that was illegal. Anyway, one of them opens up the bag and he sees my hot water bottle in there and he says, "What the hell have you got that in here for?" And he holds up the hot water bottle by its neck and he says, and I said, "Oh, well, I'm getting quite old now and my feet get really cold at night and I need the hot water bottle." And he said, "What, in a motel?" And I said, "Yes, it's really cold." And another one of the blokes stepped up beside him, equally brutal looking and with a beard and a savage expression, and he took the hot water bottle off him and he came over to me and he held it out to me and he said, when he got close to me, I looked at his eyes and he had these really warm, twinkly eyes. He was obviously a really sweet guy masquerading as a tough brute. And he says to me, "Are you an Australian author?" And I said, yes. And he said, "Well, the important thing is that you should be comfortable." And he pulled the hot water bottle into the suitcase and zipped it up. And then, yeah, it turned out later his wife had written a book and he wanted some publishing advice. So, you know, it's easy to make the wrong judgment.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr and I'm talking to Helen Garner about The Mushroom Tapes, the book she has written with Chloe Hooper and Sarah Krasnostein about the trial of Erin Patterson. There is a beautiful detail early in the book where you hesitate to look at Erin Patterson in the dock. And you're not the only people hesitating to look. There's a kind of fear of being seen by her, or what is it? I mean, it disappears, but there at the beginning, there is this reluctance to actually look at the accused.
Mm. Well, in my experience, that's quite unusual. I think, I don't know if other people feel this, but I know that the first time, if I go to write about, if I go to see a trial, my initial urge is always to have a look at the person, the accused person. And I think most people would agree with that and find it true about themselves. But Erin Patterson seemed to exude a kind of force that we couldn't sort of deal with. It's very hard to describe this. And in the book, at various different points of the trial, we talk about the difficulty we had in looking at her and our anxiety about being looked at by her. That was another thing. It's not that she was sinister, but there was this sense of darkness about her. And you have to be a bit careful with strange murderers, because a lot of projection goes on. You know, you're projecting onto them feelings that you've had about other murders or books mm-hmm. you've read or fairy tales you've read about a scary, evil people. And we didn't want to be the sort of observers who were going to start throwing the word evil around.
Yes.
And I think that's one thing that's sort of rather shocked me about some of the photos that were published of her in the press during the course of the trial, especially towards the end. And the court artist seemed also to be doing a lot of this same projecting, making her look sinister and evil. And I was shocked because that's not what she looked like. She looked like a dark, silent person, but deeply, deeply damaged and unhappy. But not playing any of this out. But she's also, the thing about her is she's highly intelligent. It became clear. She's highly educated. She's a middle-class person. I think that's one reason why the trial has attracted so much attention, because it wasn't a story from, you know, the depths of suffering and brutality in society. This was a highly educated middle-class woman of a great articulacy when she spoke. She spoke with authority, and we couldn't kind of nut her out. You know, we couldn't get a handle on who she was, and that's what puzzled us all the way through, and I think still puzzles everybody about her.
You said about this trial, and you've said about other trials that you've written about, that you have this sense of it could be me in the dock. Is it? It could be me as a human being, as basic as that. How?
Yeah, it's as basic as that, because I think that people in general suffer from enormous gusts of feeling that they only barely control. I think human beings are full of violence, potential violence and rage, and in order to live in society, when we're raised as children, we're taught to control the destructive parts of our nature. And it's a big struggle, and it's a struggle that goes on all the while. And, of course, I don't mean only physical destruction. I mean sorts of psychic destruction that we can wreak on other people or that we have to fight in close relationships. And I look at the person in the dock as somebody who's lost that struggle in themselves, who's at some certain moment let it rip. And I think that's what I mean. So it's on a basic human level.
Unlike your other two authors, you take the faith of the family that she slaughtered very seriously, the Baptist faith. Why is that? Where does faith sit with you these days?
I would call myself a Christian. It's not something I was never baptised as a child. I didn't come from a religious family. So it's only during my adulthood that I found my way to some kind of Christian awareness or finding things about the, not the church, but the Bible, I suppose. Things that I found useful and in practical ways and that hearten me and help me in my life. And there's an enormous moral thing that goes with that. And so I was very interested in I've never personally known any Baptists. You know, I think the Baptists are famous for good works. One of the expressions they used about it, the three of us went one day to the church. The one survivor of the murders that day was
a preacher.
He was a pastor of the local Baptist church. Yeah, he'd been there for a long time, and we went one day to look at the church and just to get the feel of what it was like up there on the hill, and I wanted to ask him things. I wanted to ask him if he believed that his wife still existed somewhere, if he believed that there was an afterlife. How did he had happened, this dreadful thing that had happened in their extended family, did this disturb his ability to rest in, well, what he would call rest in Jesus? I wanted to ask those sorts of questions, and I thought, they're not the sort of questions you can just barge up and ask somebody in that kind of milieu.
Ask a stranger, yes.
Yeah, and a stranger who's suffering, and a stranger who's... He seemed a very impressive person to us in the court. He gave evidence steadily and calmly, and the whole bunch of them, the Baptists that we saw there, they seemed like ordinary, decent country people. And that's one of the things that was so horrendous, trying to think, why would you want to kill these people? Why did she want to kill them? And we still don't really know.
Mm. One of the revelations of the book for me was that Erin Patterson was a fan of true crime, and that she was part of a true crime group.
A Facebook group, yes, and that was their focus. The group started as a group that was interested in the case of Kelly Lane, who I think people in Sydney might be aware of particularly.
Because who was accused of killing her babies.
Yes, and they were very fascinated by that case and spend a lot of time thinking about it and talking about it. I think the women that were in this group was quite a big group, and then as the years went by, it became smaller and smaller, and several of its remaining members gave evidence in the trial about her. But it seemed to us, from what we heard in evidence, that she was a rather lonely person, a solitary person, and these were her main friends, it seemed to us. There was no one there for her from family in the court. She had no intimate people supporting her.
They'd all dumped her.
Well, I don't know if she'd ever had any.
Yes.
I don't know.
Yeah.
What
emerges is the picture of a woman who felt badly done by, who felt used, felt neglected. But was that rational? Was she really as lonely and uncared for as she'd come to think?
Her version that she told in when she was on the stand of her and in other interviews that were used on paper in the trial, she painted a very black picture of her mother, for example, a very dark picture, and one strange thing that happened was that all three of us found, as the trial went on, that we already knew certain people who were close to her.
Yes, you had these connections.
They just popped up. And one of them was a former professor at Monash. And Erin Patterson's mother was, her field was children's literature. And she was, that's what she taught at Monash. And so the professor, which I'm not sure anyway whether she was a professor or not, but the well-known and well-respected Brenda Nile told me that she had known her mother. Her name was Heather Scudder. And Brenda thought the world of her. She said she was a marvellous teacher, very, very intelligent, and had done a marvellous thesis, which I suppose was a doctorate. And her classes were, the students loved her. And her classes were always crowded and packed, and she was highly, highly appreciated person on the staff. And Chloe went and dug through some stuff on the internet and found a lot of stuff that she'd written, you know, her sort of studies. And she was one of those kick-ass feminists from the 70s, you know, when everybody was analysing everything through a feminist lens, and her, she was... seemed a very impressive person.
But maybe not an affectionate mother.
Well, yes, according to Erin Patterson, she wasn't. But the thing about Erin Patterson is that she told a hell of a lot of lies, and they were exposed mercilessly by in evidence. And you just didn't know what to believe of what she said.
The link with children's literature, though, it's a fascinating point that Sarah makes in the book, that mushrooms crop up all the time in fairy tales.
Yeah, oh, I think it was Chloe who said that, actually. Because Chloe...
Apologies.
Chloe published a book not long ago about when her husband was extremely ill and it was thought that he might die, and they have got two young children, and she wrote this beautiful book about the sorts of stories that you can read to kids that there is a really marvellous book. And so she's looked into fairy stories a lot, and she says they're everywhere, mushrooms are everywhere. They're like little houses. They have all sorts of strange functions. And
they also poison in fairy tales, don't they?
Yes, yeah.
Can you explain a couple of statements that you make in this book which I believe require explanation? For instance, everyone should smile less, especially women in public.
Well, I've got a thing about teeth. I mean, well, no, it's because my teeth, like I'm old and my teeth have all gone yellow, and I've got one sort of like a crown at the front from where I once walked into a metal shelf and smashed my tooth when I was drunk, I confess. And so, my teeth are sort of pretty disastrous. They work, but they don't look good. And so I'm kind of envious of people with beautiful teeth. But everyone in the world now, or you look on TV and everybody is smiling and beaming and showing the total rack of perfect teeth. And so it's partly my envy of people who can do those enormous smiles and be proud of what's inside their mouth. But it's also, there's something kind of moronic about it that you see everybody's got to smile all the time. And I get those smiles, they can't possibly have any meaning. Smiles should have meaning. They should carry a bit of a freight and not be just something you switch and flick on when someone points a camera at you.
You've absolutely converted me to that idea.
I beg your pardon?
You've converted me to that idea
at
once. We should go about sort of more blank in public.
Not blank.
Not blank.
But with an interested expression on your face. I think I've got a big thing about eye contact at the moment. I would love to...
Less of or more required?
I think there should be more. Yeah, I think eye contact is something that's dying out, and I think it's basically because everyone's looking at their phone all the time. But I know this was something we noticed a lot at the trial among the journalists, lack of eye contact, which we interpreted in many ways as, unnatural and strange. I think one thing...
Shifty.
It's more like... I think what happened when we arrived, because as the first sentence of the book points out, we weren't there for the first 5 days or so, that the journalists, and there are heaps of journalists because they were from all over the place, there'd be 50 journalists sort of rushing about, and they'd already formed into a gang, and
yes,
we weren't in it. And it seemed that they wanted us not to be in it, and... we did know a couple of them. The other two, Chloe and Kraz, knew a couple of the journalists already, and I didn't, because I'm a generation older than Sarah and Chloe, and so there was this sense that we weren't welcome when we walked in because it was such a small court.
How on earth did you find seats?
Well, there weren't any. But see, this is what happened. It's a small court. There's only about like 30 or 40 seats there, and only six of those were reserved for the press, for media. And there was a lot of local interest, obviously, and there was quite a few. I think some of the Baptist community would come to support the family, the remains of the family, and so the media seats were pretty much at a premium and they were sort of balloted every day. But so this was very awkward for the media. So down the end of the hallway in this court, there was what they called the overflow room. And in there was a big screen and a live feed from the court so you could see the witness. And so if you weren't lucky enough to get one of the seats in the court, you went to the overflow room. So that's the sort of gang factor, I think. That year we walked in there, and you expect when you walk into a room full of other sentient beings that they might let everybody, or a lot of them might sort of look up and just acknowledge that another sentient being has walked in.
But not a pack of press.
No. So is this something that you've noticed as in your life as a journalist?
Yes, yes.
The formation of gangs?
the formation of gangs, particularly in remote destinations. I will never forget the gang that formed when I was out in Alice Springs covering the tour of the then Prince of Wales and Lady Di. Yeah. And there were these, there was this the British press, and they were a gang. And I watched them making up stories.
Making them up?
Yeah. Because if you make up stories, you all have to agree on making up stories. So, so a real gang.
Yeah.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Helen Garner about many things, including the trial of Aaron Patterson. Helen, there's a tricky thing about writing about trials, isn't there? That trials don't naturally roll out in a narrative. That the evidence jumps back and forth, that between the opening addresses and the closing addresses, there's just a huge jumble of evidence. And you as the writer have to turn that into a story.
Mm.
How do you approach that?
The transcript is useful. I should just say one thing about the gang nature of journalists. When I first went to the Farquharson trials in that book I wrote called This House of Grief,
yep.
We started off the committal down in Geelong. So I rock up and there was a bunch of journalists there, and straight away they were welcoming to me. They introduced themselves to me. I didn't know them. And they were very kind to me. And I found that there was a comradely feeling among them, which I greatly appreciated. And the one thing that they said to me was, are you on the list? And I go, what list?
The list.
And they say, well, if you go to, there's a list of people who get sent the transcript free every evening. By the time you get home from court, the transcript is there in your inbox. And I said, how do I get on that list? They said, well, just go up to the tip staff and give him your name, and the judge has to say if you're okay or not. And I remember this is the first time I ever said anything like this. So I went up to the tip staff and I said, oh, hello, my name's Helen Garner. I was just wondering if I could get on the list to get the transcript. And he said, oh, yeah, I'll just have to run that past the judge. And I said, I think his honour may be familiar with my work.
Oh.
I couldn't believe it when these words came from my mouth.
But they had to. It was a professional necessity.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's part of my grandmother thing that you mentioned early on, that I sort of have this natural thing where I feel I have to sort of timidly present myself, and they're probably going to say, oh, piss off, don't be ridiculous.
Did you get the transcripts?
I did.
Isn't
from
it
that day on,
life-changing.
It is the most fantastic thing.
Yes.
But as you say, it is a transcript of a jumble. And so you've got to sit there in court and you've got to be absolutely wide awake for all those hours with your notebook, looking at the people and listening to people's tones of voice and trying to get a handle on it. And when I first wrote, when I wrote that book called Joe Cinque's Consolation, that was the first time I'd sat through a whole trial. And back then I had to pay $500 to get the transcript. From there.
That's $500 almost a page, was
yeah.
that?
Anyway, so I'd been paying for it, but when I got the transcript the first time, I thought, hooray, now I've got it, here's the story, and it'll all be set out really easily and I'll be able to follow it.
Oh, no.
And I opened it up and it was just this mess of, they start here and then they withdraw and then they go over there and then now suddenly they're talking about the end of it. And I was in despair. So I think, in a sense, writing a book like that on one level is just a huge editing job. You've got to move great bulky slabs of speech around and make them still sound like speech. And see, I love all that. That is absolutely what I love to do as work. And I think I've got to be quite good at it now. But it's
you've got one or two pluses.
But it is. It's a thrilling thing to me, a trial. And as you say, in the sense that there are two narratives being put forward in a trial, the prosecution one and the defence one, and they sort of don't match. And that's the whole point.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Well, I can take any amount of that. But
you love it.
Yeah, I do. I adore it. And I remember in one review of one of my books, you said that my book was a love song to the law. And I was so thrilled that you'd said that.
Yes, exactly. Helen, at the end of the hearing of all of the evidence, when the sentencing came, oh, and I love that scene where you and all of the journalists are in a cafe when word comes through, when word comes through that the jury is returning and everybody rushes to pay. And what happens?
And they say, don't pay now, come back later, go, run.
When she is being sentenced, the judge says, only you know why you committed these crimes. And that's true, isn't it?
Especially in this case, I think. Very true. A lot of people have asked us, just in general conversation, people we know, saying, well, why did she do it? What was her motive? And people say, what was the motivation?
And that's the principal question that the three of you discuss again and again and again, all through the book.
Yeah. And we don't know. We don't know the answer. And that was one thing that I never realised this until this trial, probably, that it was, but the judge stated it many, many times to the jury. He kept saying, motive, the prosecution does not have to prove a motive. And I think most people walk around thinking that they do. That's one of the things the prosecution is doing, is coming up with a motive and proving it. But as the judge said to the jury many times, and he was a terrific judge. The way he ran the trial he was a warm, kind person and smart. And he made it possible for the jury to think. You know, I think that's a really wonderful thing. But he kept saying this over and over again. They don't have to prove a motive. We don't know why she did it, and she probably doesn't know why she did it either. And I wonder if we'll never know, because we don't know what was in her head.
And she, of course, is appealing the conviction.
Mm.
I don't know what the timetable for that is, but she's coming back to court at some point.
She hopes to.
She hopes to,
well, she's got a new lawyer, yeah.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live, and I'm talking to Helen Garner about the Mushroom Tapes, the book she's written with Chloe Hooper and Sarah Krasnostein about the trial of Erin Patterson. Helen, you've just been given a huge prize in Britain for your diaries. Can I complain about your diaries for a bit?
Yeah, go right ahead.
They end in 1998, the published diaries. That's over 25 years ago. They go from the writing of First Stone to a bit after Cosmo Cosmolino. You're still keeping diaries? Yes.
Yes.
She nods yes. So when are we going to see more?
Oh, is that a complaint?
That's my complaint.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't know. See, somebody else asked me this the other day, and I thought, I've got plenty of stuff there. You know, it goes on, and I'm still writing it now. But the diary, the published one, which is called How to End a Story, it ends in 98, as you said. In the year 2000, I went back to Melbourne. I've been living in Sydney for quite some years, and my marriage broke up, and eventually my daughter rang me up and said, we're having a baby. You can come home now. So I basically just threw everything in a truck and went down the hill. So the next 25 years of my life up until now, and continuing, touch wood, have been the happiest years of my life. And they are my years of being a grandmother. And I wound up living in a house next door to my daughter and her husband, and one by one they had three kids. And so I've been a sort of hands-on nana, just part of a sort of functioning part of the family for all those years. And so if I published the diaries I kept over those years, it would be very exposing to those grandchildren, and I don't know if that's a good idea. I don't know if they would like it. And I mean, it's packed with stuff about them. You know, when I look back at them, I'm just in fits of laughter the whole time.
Oh, they'd adore it, wouldn't they?
Well, I don't know. I don't know.
Maybe up till the time they're adolescents.
Yeah.
That's when embarrassment starts, isn't it?
I suppose it does. But people have retrospective embarrassment.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what I imagined. I know that I would love to do it. But I do feel constrained by their sensitivities. And they, I mean, they say, my grandson, about whose footy team I wrote the season, he doesn't seem to have suffered at all from it. I mean, he's
I can't imagine he would have.
Well, he's a rambunctious kind of kid, and he's a very cheerful and confident kid, and made that way by football, in a sense. But, yeah, I just, yeah, well, maybe I should ask them.
I reckon.
You think I should?
Well, I think you should, because however difficult or embarrassing it might be for you, I want to read the diaries. Mm. This is my problem. I can't say that I'm speaking dispassionately here. I want to read them.
Okay. All right. I'll check and let you know.
Thanks, Pam. Hey, is any day wasted where you don't make a diary entry? Is that your way of saying I have lived today?
Sometimes I'm surprised to find that I haven't written for maybe 2 days. But that's just because I've been too flat out doing work things. But funny you should say that, because I saw something, and this goes back to when you asked about Christian things. Recently somewhere I saw a line, I think it's from a psalm somewhere, and it says, "This is the day that the Lord hath made. I will rejoice and be glad in it." And I thought, gee, that's great. I'm going to say that to myself every day. And so I do. I say, wake up in the morning and I'm thinking, oh, God, I have to do this and that. And I go, hold on, say the thing. And the more it comes to mind, the more I think it's really quite challenging. It's not one of those sort of wet things that you would pin up on your kitchen wall. It's basically...
It's got obligation in it.
Well, yes, it has, and challenge. And it says, well, this is the day that the Lord has made. You could interpret that as being, these are the cards you've been dealt. So it's no good whinging about it. Rejoice and be glad in it, even if it's hard and you don't know how you're going to get through it. Give it your best shot. That's how I interpret it. And it's almost like saying, this is your fate. Your fate is in this day. It presents itself to you every day. And make what you can of it and do it, for God's sake, cheerfully.
And is the diary your way of reckoning whether you've lived up to your obligations?
Oh, yeah. Heavy duty self-examination.
But also full of gorgeous small detail.
Yeah, I hope so. Well, yeah, I'm glad about that. You know, some of the details I write down in my notebook, with a notebook I carry around with me. But I notice I don't do that so much anymore. It's partly because... when you're old, you can strike up a conversation with anybody. That's the wonderful thing about being old. Nobody's scared of you, and they don't get snobby with you. You know, people have got, I think people have got a sort of genial approach to a nana sort of archetype. And
your disguise?
It's not really disguise. Like, for example, somebody stood up for me on the tram. Well, somebody's husband stood up for me on the tram, and so I sat down next to this woman who was his wife, and she smiled at me, and she had on her knee a paper, like she'd been shopping, and I could just see, I glanced into it with my, slid my eye sideways, and I thought it was a shoebox, and I thought, oh, my God, she's bought some shoes. And once I would have just thought about shoes, but these days I say, oh, have you just bought some shoes? Give us a look. And so she goes, oh, okay, and so she opens the box and shows me the shoes, and she says, they're for work. I say, what's your work? And so then I get into that sort of conversation.
Yeah.
And it's fun, so I'm never bored.
Do you think that in your writing you are always at some level trying to find out, trying to identify what we all share? Is that what it's about?
Yes.
Recognising ourselves in your work.
Yes, I think so. It took me a while to twig that. And I think it was publishing the diaries that made that clear to me, because I was really surprised by the number of people that would say to me that they'd saw themselves there, and especially when you're writing about things that are miserable and you think you are the only person who is that stupid and that miserable. And then you find that people say to me, that could be my marriage. I say, what? Really? It's not just me? It's as if by writing a diary and trying to be as brutally candid with yourself about yourself, you drop down a level into the place where everybody else is. And that's been a wonderful revelation to me.
Do you think one of your primary themes is decency?
Yeah, I do.
What is it?
I think it's partly to do with being open to other people and open to life and what it throws up. And I think everybody in their heart knows what decency is, because when it's violated, people feel disgust and scorn, and they say, oh, that's not the decent way to behave. You know, there's a sense that somewhere we agree that we've got to be, well, the word kind isn't even right. It's just that you've got to find a way to treat up. What are we doing here? How did we get here? And what am I supposed to do about all the other people that are here and the people that I come up against or with every day? Am I going to go around making everybody miserable by being mean to them or taking things from them or not listening to them? Or am I going to expose myself to them in some way so that we can know each other?
And on the other hand, your work to me seems to become more and more recognising how completely appalling human beings can be.
Yeah. Yes. And that's one reason why I love courts, because that's what happens in courts. Courts are our formalised way of dealing with the absolute frightfulness that there is in all human beings, potential or actual. I think that's why I love them so much, because they're sort of earnest. And I'm not stupid. I know that a lot of terrible things can happen in courts, and the law can be distorted and corrupted and can be stupidly misunderstanding. But it's as if we've devised all these laws that are supposed to kind of make things work, make society work. And I think that's this is off on a tangent, but you know when all those people, what are they called, sovereign citizens?
Oh, yes.
Who I find just completely incomprehensible and enraging. And I think when they brag about how individual they are and how special they are, I just want to say, well, listen, don't go to hospital, because you can go and build your own hospital. Go and train your own doctors. Dig yourself a swimming pool. I just think the idea that people are not part of society is just so revolting and stupid to me. I can't stand it. And it makes me want to get my AK-47 and go out in the streets.
Is your love of the courts and the law also because you believe in punishment?
Well, that's really an interesting question. Perhaps I could say that I believe in consequences and that you should have your nose rubbed in them. That punishment, hearing about at the sentencing hearing of Erin Patterson, hearing about the conditions under which she's incarcerated, it really shocked me and sort of grieved me. I think I'm talking about the fact that she's what's called, I don't know, a prisoner at risk, because the other prisoners hate her and want to hurt her.
Yes.
And attack her. And so she's been in what amounts to solitary confinement now for like a year. She's isolated from other prisoners. And there are other prisoners who are at risk of being bashed up by their fellow inmates. And so you might get a couple of people who are in this protection unit. But if they start to turn on each other, there's an even more extreme isolation unit. I think it's called the Gordon unit in the prison that she's in.
Good Scottish name, yes.
Yeah. And they described the size of her cell and the fact that there is a little kind of opening at one end of the cell out of which very occasionally she's allowed to step, so that she's just for a moment standing in a fenced-in little area where there's air and a bit of sky maybe visible. And she's allowed to go to the library, but she can only go to the library when two prison guards can go with her. And because they're understaffed, it's very rare that they can get two who are free to take her to the library. And that there's only one person in this extreme protection unit that she's allowed to talk to, I think must be in the next cell. And that is a person called Momina Sharma. And she was a Bangladeshi PhD student. And she got some sort of scholarship to La Trobe. This is quite 5 or 6 years ago. And when she came here, she, to cut a long story short, she brought a really big knife with her in her luggage from Bangladesh, and she was put with a homestay family. And I have to tell this story briefly. She behaved weirdly with the knife with the first family she was with. And so the homestay company, which is a private company, said, oh, they looked down their list and said, oh, we'll find another place to put her while we find another permanent place for her. So instead of calling the cat team, which was what they should have done. But so they put her with this family, and she attacked the father of the family with her knife, which she'd brought specially to kill anyone she could kill because she was a radicalised and obviously mentally ill Muslim. She fell upon this man when he was having a nap with his little baby, his child, on a summer afternoon and stabbed him so hard in the neck that the tip of the knife snapped off. And he survived somehow. You know, there was blood everywhere and the screaming kid. And so...
But she ended up in prison.
So she got something like 50 years, and she's only like in her 20s. She's got a huge sentence. She is the only person in the prison that, in this protection unit, that Erin Patterson is supposed to be allowed to talk to. So far, they have not spoken to each other. So that's the limit of her human interaction in the prison. And in the very last part of the book where we put this in the book, I was so horrified by that. I still, the horror of that cell is sort of unspeakable to me. I think her defence imagined that having that described by somebody who works at the prison at the hearing would perhaps persuade the judge to give her a parole date. And he did give her a parole date, partly because he said, she's going to be a prisoner at risk always. She's a notorious prisoner. People are writing books about her. She's out there. She's a figure in the public imagination. So he did give her a parole date.
When?
I think it was 33 years, something like that. She would be in her early 80s by the time she was allowed to apply for parole.
Helen, thanks for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you, David.
I've been talking to Helen Garner, who's one of the three authors of The Mushroom Tapes, conversations about a triple murder trial, with Chloe Hooper and Sarah Krasnostein, published by Text. And the diaries are now in this beautiful, fat, single edition called How to End a Story, with a phenomenally young photograph of Helen Garner on the cover, looking dangerous. Helen, how old were you when that photograph was taken?
It must have been taken, I would say, in the early 90s, so you do the math.
At a time when she describes her life as off the chain.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. This is Late Night Live. And that's the show. Bruce Shapiro is on our next to discuss the latest twist in the endless Epstein story. And we're going to be looking at the task ahead for the battered islands of the Caribbean after Hurricane Melissa. And the story of foxes in Australia, how they conquered this land in record time.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.